It's the hardest song I've ever worked on in my life. The hardest rock music, blues music. You have an edge because you've heard so many before. There's a million licks in there in your imagination. But when someone goes, what do you put in there?
What would you do if your dreams came true and you just couldn't handle it? If an ambition you'd been chasing since childhood was finally realised, but it didn't solve any of your problems? That guitar you're hearing is being played by Eric Bell, founding member of Thin Lizzy. Marking 40 years since the band's first hit single Whiskey in the Jar, I went to visit Eric at his home in a remote part of West Cork. There we talked about music and guitar playing, and why sometimes in life the best thing you can do is quit.
After I left school, I had to get a day job, so I became a motor mechanic. But I was put on with this guy. I was his apprentice. Now, motor mechanic apprentices, especially in those days in Belfast, I would do all the dirty jobs, like change wheels diagonally, clean oil sumps, do all these mundane jobs. And this guy would do all the nice work, you know. And one day, I was sitting in the car. The guy I was on with was underneath the car doing something. So I put the radio on as I'm working on the car. And all of a sudden, this song comes on. And it's Route 66 by the Rolling Stones, off their first album. And I'd never heard it before in my life. And the guy put it on, and I just stopped. I just stopped working. And it was one of the most incredible things I ever heard in my life. It was just perfect. The sound, the tone, the feel, everything about it was just perfect. So about 4 days later, I went up to the boss's office and I rapped the door and he says, "Come in." "Yes?" I says, "I'd like my cards, Mr. Gawler." "Geraldine, get Bell his cards." So I was in a trance, basically. So I got my employment cards and the money I was owed, and that was it. So I ended up with about 14 jobs in the space of about a year and a half, and I got fired. Every job I got, I was fired because I had no interest. The jobs I had, you wouldn't believe it if I told you. A pickle factory, a shirt factory, Falls Mills, lamplighter, no gas lamps.
Yeah, well, you had to go around lighting the gas lamps at night.
Yeah, with this little bloke. And one night I come home, and I was like manic depressive at this point. I didn't know what to do with my life. I was like, no direction. One night I come home from the job, and I went up to my bedroom, and I just lay down in the bed, and my guitar is sitting staring at me. And that's when the change happened. I was sitting, lying in bed, smoking cigarette after cigarette. What am I going to do, you know? I couldn't fit in. I could not take the 9-to-5 world. I just couldn't take it. I couldn't relate to the guys. I used to sit on my own and have my lunch over there and everybody else over here. And this particular night, I said, okay, if you're going to play the guitar, let's start. Or else sell it. And it was one of those nights that you get. And I said, you got to make your mind up tonight. And I was tired after a 9-to-5 job. It was pretty physical. I was about 16, 17. Went upstairs. I said, okay, let's start this. So I started, and I thought it all out. It took me a while, but I thought it all out. I said, what does your favourite six guitar players do that you like? So I'd analyse it and say, right, they know loads of chords, wrote that down. They know loads of scales, wrote that down. They know how to play rhythm, and I had a big list. So I said, okay, now, chords. You spend 20 minutes on chords. Now you spend 20 minutes on scales. It took me a few weeks, but I did it. And even in the morning, my guitar was under the bed, and my auntie had come up and knocked the door with a cup of tea. Right, time for work. Okay. And I get up, eyes are glued together with sleep. And I told her to wake me up 20 minutes earlier so that I could play the guitar.
Could go over what you did the
man. What I learned last night. So I get up and I no more want to play the guitar in a man around. And it was like somebody else had taken me over. And I said, come on. I'm just sitting there alone.
Aspiring guitarist in the 1960s, there was one surefire way to make music your bread earner. It wasn't exciting or experimental, or even a good opportunity to exhibit your abilities. But for Eric Bell, it was a start. It was show band, a crooning cover group tradition of touring dance halls and playing it safe.
I like to play a game that is so much fun, that back to very hard to do. The name of the game is Simple Simon Says. I would like you for the players to put their hands in the air.
Simple Simon Says. Absolutely embarrassing. It was so bad. And I just stayed because I didn't have to work during the day. That's the only reason I stayed. I mean, there was stuff you go, you know, say you're going, behind the singer. And for a while I'd do this, and I'd start having a few drinks on stage, because you just can't, you know, to stay sane. And I found that my guitar player was starting to deteriorate, so I'd start going. Leave it out, man. Sick. So it started telling me to shut up.
Yeah.
And then at one point I started getting into blues. That was, you know, I'd be going. So the leader came over one night. He says, listen, I won't tell you again. You're not playing blues when the guys sing a Danny Boy, right? It's just, it's ludicrous. The thing that I had, more than other guitar players in England, was most of the guitar players in England or America, immediately they get the guitar, they go into blues. And I didn't. I went into an Irish show bands. So I've got a little part of my style that they haven't got. So I've got a little twiddle or a little, what does someone call it one day? A lilt. For a while I was trying to get rid of it. And I said, no, wait a minute, man. You've got something that most of the guys haven't got. For the very simple fact you played an Irish show band. So I use that now to my advantage rather than my disadvantage.
Having spent 3 years wearing uniform suits and strumming along to Simple Simon Says, Eric Bell was living in Dublin, where he decided to make another bold decision. Just like he'd done before when he was a motor mechanic, Eric made the choice to quit, risk it all, and start something new.
You're going to leave the show band? I said, yeah. these are the guys in the show band and the management. What are you going to do? I'm going to form a group. You're going to form a group? Yeah. Have you any musicians? No. Have you any transport? No. Got a PA? No. You got an amplifier? No. Because the amplifier belonged to the band. And I'm going, I haven't got anything. And a week later I said, Eric, you better get up off your arse, man, and start doing this. You got to go out. I went to these pubs and clubs and asked musicians. Just walked over. My hair was up to here, show band haircut. Wearing a show band suit, because that's all I had. So I looked like somebody out of a drug squad. And I'd be walking into the bailey, and there'd be five guys sitting there with their hair down to their shoulders, obviously a group. And I'd go and say, excuse me, I'm Eric Bell out of the Dream Show Band. They're going, and I said, what have I done? And I'm standing there ordering half pints now because I've no money. I'm standing up at the bar, and Eric Rickson walks in. What are you doing tonight? I said, not much. Let's go down to Countdown Club. I didn't know who was playing there that night. Didn't even know if anyone was playing. And then Eric says to me, have you ever tried LSD? And I said, no. Do you want to try some? I said, yeah. So he brought out this little micro dot, this little tablet. He broke it in half and he says, put that in your tongue. So I'm standing there and like... So at that point in time, the band came on. And it was Orphanage, and Philip was the singer, didn't play bass, just out the front singing, and Brian Downey was the drummer. So we went over and we sat down in the yoga position that everybody was sitting in those days. Everybody sat cross-legged on the floor, watching the band,
yeah,
all rolling joints. That's what it was like. It was unbelievable. Next minute, I start really listening to Brian Downey's drumming. Amazing. I'm going to get him for my group. Not having a clue whether he was going to join or not. Now, this is why I think Thin Lizzy was meant to be. Why did I meet Eric Rickson that night? Why did we go to Countdown? Why was Orphanage playing? And why, when they took a break, only Philip and Brian Downey walked over to the changing room? So I was feeling reasonably normal. Raps at the changing room door. Come in. Walked in, Philip sitting there, Brian. Never met him before in my life. Yeah, can we help you? I said, and the asses started kicking out. And they're going, are you all right? I said, yeah, it's my first trip on acid, sorry. And they went, what? What's it like, man? So we started talking and I said, I've just left the Dream Show Band. I want to form a three-piece band. I just want to know, do you know any bass players and drummers? So Phil says to Brian, hey, Brian, what's the best pub for Eric to see group musicians? Oh, I don't know, Phil. I'd say the Zodiac. Do you know what Zodiac is, Eric? I said, no. You're down Grafton Street and you turn right. Funnily enough, that's where his statue is outside there now. Weird. And I'm just about to walk out the door. This is why it's meant to be. And Phil calls me back and says, Brian, do you fancy forming a band with Eric? So that was that. Next Monday night, Philip knocks on the door, comes up to the flat, have a smoke, and I listen to three of his songs. One of them is Dublin, and we just listened to the three of them in a row. And after he turned it off, he says, well, what do you think? I said, they're fucking amazing, man. Do you think so? I says, oh, excellent. I said, I can fit my guitar playing in there. I can hear it already. So I had to borrow an acoustic guitar. I hadn't got one. Me and Phil would have to get the bus, carry our two guitars, hadn't got cases, get into Baggot Street, go to one of these pubs, and me and Philip would sit in the middle of the floor on these two seats with two acoustic guitars, and people wouldn't take a blind bit of notice of us. We were background music. And that's how Thin Lizzy started.
After our affair,
I swore that I'd leave Dublin.
We were that type of band and never thought twice about using 12-string guitars, 6-string guitars, and then we would put the electric in as well. So we had the folk world and the blues world and the rock world all intertwined. Things started happening for Thin Lizzy. We were ridiculously lucky. I don't know how that happened. To this day, I have no idea why these things happened. Once we became a three-piece, we went out and started playing around Ireland. And after about 3 months, we would play maybe the same club again in 3 months' time. And there was a queue the whole way down the street and round the corner to the door. And we'd be driving up, and I'd say to Philip, wonder who we're on with tonight. Look at the crowd. There's about 200 people queuing up. And Phil said, I don't know, Harry. And we went in and it was us. And we didn't realise. And all of a sudden, everywhere we played, there was a queue down the street. And it just took off. I don't know how or why it took off.
So we packed our bags and headed for the North Sea. There was Eric Bryan, Freaky Pete, Charlie, Frankie Lee and me.
With their unique genre-hopping sound incorporating funk, folk, rock and blues, it wasn't long before Thin Lizzy made the move to London.
And we went sailing.
But despite signing a deal with the prestigious Decca Records, the group didn't receive much by way of recognition.
Long before the fighting broke.
Our first tour of Ireland came up. Now, we were really big because we were living in England. We're still the same blokes, still playing the same. But because we were now living in England and we had all the English gear on, the best clothes that you couldn't get in Ireland, so we looked the part. And the album, our first album, Thin Lizzy, had been released. I remember it like yesterday. We checked into the hotel in Dublin where we were staying, a Skyline or wherever it was. And after about 10 minutes, Phil came down and knocked my hotel room door. Hey, Eric, I'm going down to Grafton Street. I'm going to check out the record shops. He went into all the record shops around the Keys, Grafton Street, wherever. He came back and he was like ready to kill. He says, we're here to promote the first album and they haven't got it in shops. He says, I've went into about 6 record shops. None of them have Thin Lizzy's album. He phoned the management in London. He told them, why are we here? We played everywhere. Our management had us out all the time. We were working like 5-6 nights a week, every week. And some of the dives we played in, you would not believe it. We played in Germany one night, this wine bar, and we're standing there playing. And there's a guy sent me his girlfriend about 4 tables away with a bottle of wine, looking into each other's eyes, and we're going, the bottle of wine's jumping up and down, and Phil's going, oh man.
Oh, here I'll go again, feeling low down.
I remember one day we were going to break up. Me and Philip had a fight, an actual physical fight, and Brian Downey was leaving the band that day. He said, I've had enough. And we had to beg him to stay because the man Philip had a fight. Our management had an office and they employed about 5 people. They all needed paid. And we were one of the few bands that they had. And they were working us to the bone to keep the office afloat. So we came back and they said, you're booked in the studios to do a single. A single.
This is the first single in about 3 years.
Yeah. And see, this is another reason why these things happened. I have no idea. We would rehearse in this pub in London every week. And this day, we were trying this song and there was just nothing happening at all. Couldn't get that vibe, that atmosphere, that mood. We couldn't create it. So we just put the instruments down and starting to read the melody maker. We were going to go home and Philip said, we're staying today. It was another hour and a half to go. So Philip picked up the guitar up to the microphone, started singing all these stupid songs, just taking the piss. And me and Brian sitting there reading, not taking any notice of Philip. So Phil starts singing Whiskey in the Jar. He's got on to this then. It's always going over, according. And we started messing about. I didn't have that riff, obviously. We're playing this, and all of a sudden the door opens, and Ted Carroll, one of our managers, walks in. And Ted Carroll says, "Have you got a song for the single coming on?" "No." "I think you should work on that song, Whiskey in the Jar." And we're looking at him like, "What are you talking about, man? We left Ireland to get away from this, and you want us to record it as a single? I don't think so." He says, "You should think about it." So anyway, we eventually got to the studio, but 5-6 weeks later, and we still weren't sure of Whiskey in the Jar. So we recorded Black Boys in the Corner, great track. It came out great. So then we says, "Right, what are we going to do for the B-side?" "I don't know. What do you think?" "I don't know." This little voice comes on. "Why don't you try Whiskey in the Jar?" Okay. So we went out. Me and Philip had two acoustic guitars, Brown on the drums, and the one. And that was it until the end. And then Phil put the vocals on. The drums was already on. "Right, Eric," I said, what are you going to put on the guitar?" I don't even know where to start. I hadn't a clue. I had no idea what to do. Where do you start? Or something like that. No. So one night we're coming home from a gig, and it's about 2:30 in the morning, and we're still really tired. I'm about another half hour to go to get to London, to get to our beds. And Phil always played cassettes in the car, and all smoking as usual. And he had this mixture of music. He had Bob Marley, Jimi Hendrix, ZZ Top, The Chieftains, just this rigmarole of all different types of music. So away in the background, I'm hearing The Chieftains. And all of a sudden, I start hearing the Irish pipes. The start of Whiskey in the Jar. I copy Irish pipes instead of a guitar. So after about a week, I come up with... like pipes, that yeah. So the management started hassling me, Philip started hassling me, the record company started hassling me. "When are you coming in to do the guitar work? We're waiting on you. What have you got?" I says, "I've got the intro." "Oh, brilliant. Anything else?" I said, "I'm working on it." So I'm on the way home to my flat in the taxi, and the taxi driver susses I'm Irish, and he starts, "You're from Ireland, mate?" "Yeah, me and the wife went over there last year. It's a really nice place, isn't it?" And as he's talking to me, I've heard, "Jin, jin, jin." Eventually, I've got it. I knew I had it, and the taxi driver keeps talking to me. And I don't know how to write music. I have no tape recorder. And I'm answering him, and then at the same time going... paid him the money. Ran up the stairs. Got my guitar. Got the tape. Put it in the tape recorder. And went... I learned it. Did did that three, and then as an answer. And once I got that, I heard the solo.
Perfect guitar part in place and a new record to promote, Thin Lizzy's prospects looked a little brighter. Still, the notion of some obscure Irish rockers covering an old folk song doesn't exactly spell chart success. That is, of course, until you make use of a little liquid persuasion.
You picture yourself a DJ on the radio. You're playing singles every day of your life. Oh, here we go again. But some of the singles have a freebie with them, be it a cap, a little watch type thing. We're sending out a miniature bottle of whiskey with every record. Now you imagine yourself a DJ, 2:30 in the morning, with your cup of tea, and all of a sudden, in your package of singles to be played, is a little miniature bottle of whiskey. For you. Ah, I'll certainly play this. And you pour the miniature bottle of whiskey into your tea, and this is Thin Lizzy with Whiskey in the Jar.
There's whiskey in the jar.
We're playing, at that point in time, we're playing pubs and clubs that hold maybe 250 people. And that's what we were used to playing to. So Whiskey in the Jar suddenly reaches number 6. We do Top of the Pops. It brings us way up from a mediocre band hardly anyone's heard of to we're in the top 10 now. Suddenly everybody hears who we are.
We've got a band that just a couple of weeks ago were voted Ireland's top band. They're by the name of Thin Lizzy. They don't drink whiskey by the glass, they drink it by the jar.
It's 40 years since he's were on Top of the Pops, 40th anniversary of it. They used to fly us out to different countries in Europe just to do a bit of miming on TV.
I remember it well. You go to Germany, mime a TV show. You go to Spain, mime a TV show. Go to France. Yeah. And they may as well not have been playing the guitar. It got really monotonous. You get a love-hate relationship with it. But you can take it. You can definitely take it for granted, thinking, you know, it's not that special, but whenever it doesn't happen again.
After the surprise success of Whiskey in the Jar, Eric and the band found themselves in unknown territory. Thrust into the pop parade for the first time in their lives, Thin Lizzy soon realised that the only thing harder than coming up with your first hit is coming up with your second one.
He's getting ready for tonight's song and dance. He doesn't know, he doesn't stand a chance. His last affair will be his last romance.
Our second single came off the record, and everybody said, you got to do Whiskey in the Jar Part 2. It's a guaranteed hit. Oh no, we're professional musicians. We're serious musicians. Oh, well, what are you going to do now? Well, it's a song called Randall's Tangle. So anyway, we went in and recorded it. And it went on the radio and went, never to be seen again. Things started becoming very iffy for Thin Lizzy. The management was going to drop us. The record company was going to drop us. That's all they wanted, another hit record. And everybody's happy. And we hadn't got one. And this change started happening. And then Philip started changing dramatically. He started becoming much more commercially minded. He started realizing that the music business, in a way, was the music business. He says, a lot of people only see the first word, but it's a business. He said, right, I don't care anymore. I want another hit. I want a taste of fame again. Because he had the biggest ego in the world, and he loved it. He couldn't get enough of Rush Filled Out. And I was the exact opposite. In those days, I didn't want to be known. I just wanted to play the guitar. So Philip went that way, and I went that way. And suddenly, this change started happening. That's when I started going off the rails. It's very strange going from being nobody, and nobody giving a shit what you do or how you do it, to people following you, looking upon you like a pop star, and you don't feel any different. You still feel the same, but everybody wants you to be different. So you have to exaggerate your personality to become larger than life. You start getting a bit mixed up. I did. I was drinking. I couldn't stop. I couldn't. I wanted to. We had this thing in our contract. We'd have certain things in the changing room after every gig. One of the things was a large bottle of whiskey. Every gig we played, that had to be on the table. And one of the gigs we did was the Dublin Stadium. And on stage that night, I remember distinctly, I remember turning around to Brian Downey and saying, "You know what, Brian? After the gig, I'm not having any drink. I'm going to go back to the hotel." So am I, man. End of the night, last number, "Thank you very much, good night." End of the change room, whiskey. Here we go again. And I couldn't get out of that circle. I tried, and I started not eating. I didn't exercise. I was smoking loads of dope, drinking, and I couldn't stop. I just couldn't physically stop.
Because it's always there and it's always so accessible.
You're surrounded with it 24 hours a day.
For Eric Bell, it was time once again to quit. And on New Year's Eve 1973, a homecoming gig in Belfast brought his Thin Lizzy career to a crashing end.
This night we're playing in Belfast, my hometown. And we still had the bottle of whiskey and smoking dope in the car going to the gigs. And after about four songs, I started hallucinating on stage. And meanwhile, the music's going on, seemingly without me. And I see people in the audience looking up at me as if, "What's your man doing, you know?" And I heard this voice in my head, the one that you don't usually heed, saying, "Eric, you gotta get out of here. You're a dead man. You're either an alcoholic or a junkie or a nutcase. You've got your choice. Do it now. Get your guitar, throw it up in the air, kick all your amps off and get out." And I just, it was like somebody else, some spirit that was alien to me. I got my guitar and I just took it off and I threw it up in the air as high as I could. And I seen it going up, and it just hovers for a second. And I said, "You've done it, man." And I came down. I went over to my amp, and I just went, boom. And I kicked it again, and it just went smash. And I started going off. And someone said, "Get him a taxi, get him out of here. Does anybody know where he lives?" And I got home. And I remember it, and it was a coal fire. I remember sitting in front of that fire, man, for hours, just looking into the embers. I just looked in the fire and I said, "You've done it, man. You've done it. You're out of the circus."
Just like that, you're saying all whiskey in the jar is evergreen, and well, I'm 22. Like I first heard you guys when I was 11, 12. The first band became very kind of obsessive about, you know, and it ended up the first thing for myself for listening to you. It was a really good wee compilation. I think it must have came out in the mid-90s. It was just Whiskey in the Jar was the name of the compilation, but it was just a whole smattering of things from the first three records, okay, and a few of the B-sides,
right,
and just like that, those things on it, like Remembering and, okay, Old Moon Madness, Broken Dreams.
Oh,
you know.
I was, I tell you, man, you wouldn't believe how proud I was to be in Finland in the early days. It was like, it was like a dream come true.
Leaving Eric's house that night, there were still some questions that remained unanswered. Some things that needed to be said. So before we left the car, with rain battering against the windows, Eric Bell told me, 40 years after quitting Thin Lizzy, what really matters.
I mean, why would you spend most of your life trying to be a famous guitar player, and it suddenly happens and it's in your hands, and you just go and throw it away? There's no rhyme or reason to it. It was just, unfortunately, an incredibly bad period in my life. I looked on the guitar as an evil thing, that it had caused me a lot of trouble in my life. And that's the way I looked at it, so I didn't touch it for a while. Didn't play with anybody. Didn't want to play with anybody.
So how did you fix it when you decided, I've had enough, and you had that night in Belfast, and then from there left the band? How did you managed to get things together?
Well, the first move was to leave London. I said, there's too many bad memories here for me. So I moved back to Dublin, and I bought a push bike, and I went out every day nearly cycling. Only cycled for about a few months, just to get out and air and move my body and speed up the heart a bit and so on. Because when I was younger, I was very, very health conscious. Used to exercise all the time and eat really well. That type of person, and I think that's what's seen me through.
You definitely think all the things that happened, it was meant to be.
Absolutely, there's no question about it, because I set out as a motor mechanic in the 9-to-5 world, and I found I couldn't hack the 9-to-5 world. I couldn't do it. I wasn't that way inclined, and I found I had a certain talent for the guitar, and I said, right, well, I'm going to put all my work into my talent, into the guitar. And I did for a while, and then I got fucked up with Thin Lizzy. But, you know, I mean, looking back on it now, I'm 65, right, and I'm looking back on it thinking, if nothing else, you've set out to do something and you've hit it. Because I've got some friends in Belfast. One guy I know, Billy Moore, he's my best friend. I met him at primary school when we were 5 years of age. And he phones me up from time to time. A few drinks on him, and he says, Eric, I admire you so much. He said, you had balls to leave your day jobs and to try and make it as a guitar player in the 60s, which was nearly unheard of in Belfast, or in Ireland anyway. When I look back, I can say, I was that 16-year-old guitar player who wanted to become famous, and to a certain extent I achieved it. And it's no one can take that away from me. And it's marvellous. It's marvellous. I love it. I absolutely adore it, because I think everyone should be proud of their own talent, have respect for their own talent, whatever it may be. Like, you mightn't be as good as him, you mightn't be like him. You are yourself. And that's the only thing I could say. Find your own voice. Don't be a second copy Jimi Hendrix. You know, don't be a second Eric Clapton. There's only one Jimi Hendrix. There's only one Eric Clapton. You know what I mean? It's all been done. But the way I want to do it hasn't all been done, you know? So that's all I have. And you'd think, I'm going to go now, but you'd think it would be the easiest thing in the world to find your own voice. It's the hardest thing in the world. It really is. And I'm getting there a little bit. And to do that, you got to work.
Bell Story was compiled and presented for RTE Radio 1 Music and Entertainment by Danny Carroll.